is maybe slightly different than a normal Dharma talk. It's more about the Sangha here and our development. We had, during the last week, we filed papers for nonprofit status as a religious organization. So the Mid Peninsula Insight Meditation Center will now be will have at some point, I don't know how long the paperwork takes, nonprofit status. And it's a small step, but a very significant one in the development of our Sangha, or development of our religious community here. And so I want to talk a little bit about that and talk about what it means for our Sangha to grow and develop, which it has a lot since the years I've been involved. Interestingly enough, the Sangha, this sitting group, started over 10 years ago, I think, in Menlo Park at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology. And the first teacher was Howie Cohen, who's coming down next Monday. So he drove down from San Francisco and every Monday and took care of it for a number of years until his schedule didn't allow for it anymore. And then for a few years it was without a teacher, but had a wonderful man and his wife, Howard and Ingrid Noodleman, who were the mentors of the group. And then in 1990, Howard could no longer do it, and I was invited, I was asked to come and be the teacher for the group. And it's grown then from 12, there were about 12 people in 1990 when I started. And what's kind of very happy, I think, is that a lot of those people, who are those 12, are still around. At least half of them, I can easily count, and probably more. And a very stable group and committed people. So development of the Sangha. And traditionally in Buddhism, there are considered to be three important supports for Buddhist practice. And that's known as a triple refuge, the support of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And what often happens in Buddhist circles, I think almost everywhere, but certainly in America, is that the Buddha and the Dharma often get emphasized, and the Sangha gets de-emphasized, or not de-emphasized, but doesn't get as much press as the first two. And the importance of Sangha, the importance of religious community of fellow practitioners, is considered to be equal on par with these other two, the Buddha and the Dharma. And in fact, they're considered to be three legs of a tripod supporting the practice. And I understand that a healthy spirituality, a healthy Buddhist spirituality, involves having a healthy balance of these three aspects. And the Buddha means many things, but in Buddha is the inner experience, the inner state, the inner possibility of being awake, of being present, of being compassionate. The Dharma is many things again. It's the simplest definition is the teaching which supports that inner awakening and compassion and love. But it also is, one of the definitions of Dharma is nature. It's the nature we find ourselves, the nature of reality itself. And the Sangha is the people we practice with, fellow practitioners. And one of the things I love about the definition of Sangha is that by defining it as fellow practitioners, it's a very porous and loosely bounded community. The Sangha doesn't have an institutional identity. It never is supposed to have an institutional identity. Like, it's not like, this is your Sangha and this is it. You know, many of us say this is our Sangha, but then what is this, you know, where's the limits of the Sangha? Well, you know, it's very porous and open. There is no, you know, we don't have an institutional identity. It's really like membership and really solid thing. And I think that's true for all Buddhist groups, is that the Sangha is a porous and loose body of people that is shared, these people who share a common intention and practice of awakening, of presence, of compassion and love. So I like that because it's an informal definition which allows for a certain kind of informality of coming and going. That people can come and go in and out of a Sangha without any barriers either in or out. And I feel that's the way we are as a Sangha here in Palo Alto. I feel like we're an informal group with very relatively open doors, and people wander in and wander out. And even though we're informal, one of the things that's been very gratifying for me over the years that I've been here is how much a sense of community has arisen in the people who come here regularly. And it varies a lot from person to person how connected they feel. We don't have a lot of organized ways of helping people get connected. But just being around each other. A lot of friendships are developed here, a lot of connections. And it's been very kind of, for me, a very happy thing to have watched. Sometimes I've seen some of you kind of becoming friends and doing things together, and I said, what about me? You know, I sit up here all alone, you know. It's very lonely, you know. Not really, but anyway, it's been very gratifying to see the sense of connectedness I see in the room that happens slowly. Probably more slowly than maybe it should be, because it's kind of hard, I think, to come in as a stranger into a group you don't know. But if you have, those of you who are new, I think, you know, we should, of course, be more welcoming and have ways of making more connection, but we don't have a lot. But it just happens, just being together and practicing together. Now, the balance between, you know, the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha is also a balance between individual needs and community needs, or community involvement. And this is one of the great tensions in many people's lives between solitude or individuality and community and connectedness with others. And for some people, it's a tension, those two. And depending on how they look at it any particular day, some people who are completely frightened of organized religion of any form, because really what's important is their own practice, their own independent awakening and freedom, and they don't want to get tied up in anything. And other people who feel, well, actually what's important is the community connection, the relationship, that maybe doesn't make any sense to talk about freedom and awakening unless you're also talking about being connected in community. And without connection in community, freedom maybe doesn't really even exist. Even though in American culture the idea is freedom means you're out, you know, on your pony on the plains by yourself under the stars and no one within miles around. You can do whatever you want. In Zen Buddhism there's this beautiful poem, the title of which is called The Merging of Difference and Unity. And rather than setting up a tension between difference or duality or separation and unity or connectedness, or rather than falling into one camp or the other, saying what's important is unity, and what's important is difference and diversity. What's important is cosmic oneness, and what's important is duality of the sacred and the profane, or all kinds of different ways that people fall down in this equation. The Zen poem points at the merging of the two. How do we bring these two together so that they coexist in a balanced and a healthy way? The difference in unity, solitude and community. The Sangha is a community of practitioners that supports, encourage us in our practice. And I know that it's from my own experience, and I think from many people, it's very hard to sustain a serious spiritual practice alone. Either to keep the momentum going, the inspiration going, or to be willing to overcome or deal with or stay present for, hang out long enough, to go through some of the difficulties and demons and that might arise in a spiritual practice. And having a community is a support and encouragement. And in the 6 years now that I've been here, I feel very, you know, I'm the teacher in some sense, but who is the teacher after all? I feel very encouraged and inspired by all of you who I sit with, and the fact that many of you come regularly and have a real commitment to practice encourages and inspires me in my commitment to practice. And it probably goes around in circles, you know, and hopefully I can be somewhat of an inspiration and encouragement to you. I think that's part of the role of a teacher. But then also I receive it back. And Sangha is also a community of people that in some ways mirrors us in maybe healthy ways. When I my first inspiration to go live or be with the Buddhist community was when I noticed that that when I sat in meditation, a lot of the usual head trips, usual ego trips that I had kind of quieted down for a while. And I felt kind of integrity or kind of peace that didn't involve all my ego trips and who I wanted to be and presenting myself to, how I wanted to present myself to other people. And I could see the difference between my meditation experience of myself and how I was in relationship to other people, where all my old trips came back. And I didn't like the difference. I wanted to find a way to have that integrity in my daily life also. And I noticed when I went to the San Francisco Zen Center to visit, that people there didn't want to play those games with me that I was used to playing with my friends. And in meeting them, they were my mirror for me. I would act out, you know, and nothing happened. They didn't play the game. You know, they weren't playing that game. So suddenly it was kind of like bewildering. And it felt, and I wanted to be around people who mirrored that for me, because I didn't want to live those old games anymore. I wanted to have them shown to me. But many things are mirrored in any kind of community, but certainly a spiritual community. Not only our trips, but also our beauty and our potential for love and compassion and presence. The Sangha is one of the three refuges. It's a place we go for refuge, for support. And again, as I said, I think it's impossible to really do this kind of spiritual practice alone. The Buddhist dogma, whatever that's worth, teaches that it's, unless you're a Buddha, it's impossible to do this path, this practice, alone without the support of others. The manifestation of practice, as people become more mindful, more open-hearted, more present, less judgmental, less comparative in their relationship to other people, the tendency is for there to arise increasing amounts of compassion and sense of connectedness with others. And then it's very useful to have a community of people who not only support you in practice, but then give you an outlet, a place to meet in that open-heartedness, to meet in that connection. And I think that sometimes it's very hard in wider society to have, to explore new ways of being, new sense of open-heartedness, the trustfulness, of honesty, non-defensiveness. It's very hard to experiment with these ways out there in some areas in our society where people don't understand those ways of being. And so to come to a community where you can experiment with new ways. And one of the ways that I practiced in Sangha and community in my early years of practice was I understood that Buddhist Sanghas were incredibly forgiving. That's kind of the point. Buddhist Sangha is a place where people are practicing with each other, which means that we're kind of supposed to be honest, we're supposed to be working with the difficulties, the resentments, the projections, the ideas that are going on. But more important, we're willing to hang out with each other. If there's conflict and difficulty, we're willing to hang out and not turn our backs to someone. So I kind of got a sense of all that. So I started experimenting when I first started hanging out with the Zen community, was because I didn't know how to really be in relationship to other people in this new mode of being, coming from this integrity, coming in a way that didn't have all these trips involved. And so I experimented with, I tried for a while being really silent, not speaking to anyone. And, you know, it was a safe community to do it in because they were so forgiving and, you know, it was okay. A week later I came and started speaking and didn't stop speaking, well, they would forget the fact that I was silent for a week. It wouldn't hold it against me. And I would try that. Sometimes I spoke all the time. I remember once working at the Greens restaurant. I was kind of serving, I was one of the cooks, and it was going, dinner was being served incredibly fast. There's all these waiters and waitresses and all these bus boys, and do we say bus girls? Bus people? were coming, going by. And I tried experiments of having a continuous conversation with all of them, everyone who passed by me. And I try to remember each conversation, because they were always, you know, coming and going. I try to remember where the conversations left off, and I pick it up, and you know, it's a tremendous game, you know, conversation, and keeping the ball going. And so anyway, well, part of what a Sangha allows a person is a place to experiment with being different than how you normally be at work or in your normal social scenes. Our Sangha in Palo Alto, as I said, started 10 years ago by Howard and Ingrid Noodleman at ITP. And Howard, then in 1990 or so, was diagnosed with cancer. And so part of the history of this community is that one of the main people then died of cancer. It was very moving for many of us and painful. But it was the same time, because he was no longer able to be the mentor, and they wanted someone to kind of lead it or be a teacher for it. And that was exactly the same time I was going to start school at Stanford. It was kind of coincided almost exactly by the week. He called me up and asked if I would come down and be a teacher. And I came, and for many years I felt very shy about my role as a teacher. And I would try to call myself a mentor, or call myself something different, or try to really try to not to take a leadership role, but really kind of listen to what the community wanted, what the Sangha wanted, and try to be responsive. Because I felt I was invited, I'd been invited in. But as the community grew and grew, it became increasingly awkward and cumbersome for me to maintain that kind of stance or position. That I wasn't exactly a teacher, I wasn't exactly the leader. And so I feel now that over these 5-6 years, that in some ways I have become a teacher, and I have become a leader of sorts. But what that means, we're all working out together. But I'm not so shy exactly as I used to be around at least those kinds of names. What it means, I'm shy about still. But that's what I feel, what the whole situation has asked of all of us. And if you have different ideas, I'd like to hear it. So in 1990, I started. There were 12 of us. And it slowly, steadily grew. And as we grew, there became new needs for the community, or new desires for doing more practice, more things together. And one of the first needs was the need to offer beginner's instruction. Because the people who came just came, they knew how to practice, and new people would come, and they didn't have a clue what to do. So I started offering beginning instructions. And that was kind of the next kind of expansion of sorts. And then there was a desire, or perhaps the need, the possibility of doing one-day retreats. So then we started doing one-day retreats. And also we did, back then we did for a while, for about a year, we did half-day retreats periodically. And those were very nice. So we started doing kind of retreats for a while, or we still do one-day retreats, but we used to do it maybe 2, 3, 4 times a year, and now we do it almost every month. We do a one-day retreat, and then there were occasional potlucks and kind of get-togethers that we had, and then we grew and grew, and I was so in awe and amazed. Wow, there were 20 people who would come to this stuff. It's just, wow, you know, we've really grown a lot. And then it got to be 30. Oh, Jesus. And 35. And then the room got really tight. And, you know, sometimes it was so crowded that I felt like I was giving a Dharma talk to the person sitting in front of me. You know, 2 feet away, or someone, you know, facing me. And, you know, that's the person I spoke to, because they were face to face. And we got really crowded and full. And then Greg, who's a friend who belongs to this Sangha, the Quakers here, he sits with us. And he, because he was a friend, he knew about this room, and he came and suggested that we move over here. And so we did. And the same week that we moved over here, we jumped from something like 40 people to 60 people. Somehow, like the news of the move just kind of generated all this interest. So we were all kind of amazed. Like, where all these people come from? 3 years ago. And then we started doing monthly potlucks because we felt the need for more community and connection. And then some people felt the need for more chance to discuss and hang out with each other in a more dharmic way. So I think it was Foster who started the book club, which still continues. And then there were some attempts to try sitting times at other evenings, Wednesday and Thursday. And there were some other kind of sitting groups that kind of spawned off from this one, small ones that I think continue to this day. And then Monday started getting too full. And in the introductory course, I would do Mondays from 6:45 to 7:30. But that meant all the beginners would be here at 7:30 when all of you came. And it looked like it was going to get out of hand, because we got more and more people coming from beginning course. So we moved the beginning course to Thursday. And so I could do a more thorough job, because now instead of 45 minutes, we have an hour and a half for beginner instructions. But then once we had the beginning instructions going, we kind of, let's just continue having beginner's evenings on Thursdays and take some of the pressure off Monday. And that, so that's been worked very well for a long time. But we keep growing on Monday, and Thursday keeps growing. And we've had this current introductory course. I think there were 80 people the first night, and 70, I think, the second, which was Thanksgiving or something, and then 90 the third. and then 70 again the last time, something like that. It kind of goes up. I don't know why it changes the way it does, but anyway, a lot of people should be glad they don't come on Mondays. And so, and then we do. Then we started the weekend retreats for ourselves up in Jokoji, which we do. Usually, we try to do it twice a year: Memorial Day and some weekend in August. And then we did a senior student series for a year, which is a good idea to continue, but we're not doing it right now. And then we did for a while, and we'll start up again at some point. We did the happy hour. Which is we did in the afternoon 5:30, 6:30. We did a gathering for doing loving kindness meditation, which was I think very important for us because it's very important for some people to do loving kindness meditation. There are some people for whom I think it's actually a more suitable practice than mindfulness practice, and I feel a lack that we don't offer it again, but we will at some point. And then we do yoga now twice a month. And now the idea is maybe to try doing a children's program once a month. And you know, there's a lot of requests, a lot of ideas that people have, because it's natural, I think, as a community grows and as people invest more of their life in the practice, they wanted to include more of their life as part of the practice. And they want to include more of their life, and they want to go deeper and do more deeper kind of practice, more deeper study and involvement. And so I'm sitting here both receiving the requests from people and trying to respond, and also part of the role of a teacher is to have some sense of what the potential, the possibility of the students are, of the practitioners are. And so in a very gentle way, allow for the kind of open or kind of provide for those opportunities to allow that potential to grow. So for example, offering one-day sittings, offering longer retreats. I feel like a lot of people here were ready for doing one-day sittings. And so I didn't tell anybody you should do it, but we just offered it. And when you're ready, you come and do one-day sittings. So I see there's a lot of potential for us to go deeper and be more involved. And I get a lot of requests. So how do we respond to that? There's more things we want to do. Part of the problem we have is we don't have space to do it in. The friends have been extremely generous hosts, letting us use this room as often as we do. But they get other requests from other groups now more and more. And we've been told that basically we can't use it much more than we are already, which is probably more than they use it. So we can imagine they get a little bit nervous. And finding other places for doing one-day sittings or other kind of special workshops or retreats has been very hard. And they're expensive, and finding suitable places. And Allison has done a tremendous amount of work looking for places we can use. And she's kind of canvassed all of Palo Alto, I think, and I've looked at various places. So the sense I have of us is that we've kind of we've outgrown our shoes, but we don't have new shoes yet to step into. So we're kind of cramped, is the feeling. And maybe many of you don't feel it because it seems like a nice thing to come Monday and we sit together nicely. And it's a little bit crowded. But I feel it much more because of the position I sit in as a teacher. Because I hear the requests, I talk to a lot of you, I see the potential and the need. And also because I have a wonderful vision, which I hold. And I see there's a tremendous opportunity here in the Mid-Peninsula for doing a lot more than we already do. There's a lot of Vipassana students, let alone Buddhist students in this area, for whom there's a lot more activities we could do, we can be done, that would support their practice. And I would like, I have this vision, this dream, of being able to offer that and set up something here very solid and stable that can really take advantage both of the opportunity and of the need and the possibility here in this area. For making a very strong, viable center of Buddhist practice in this area. So 2 years ago, I was beginning to feel that I was doing more and more as a teacher, and it was becoming more and more of my what I did most of the time was take care of the sangha, and I didn't want for me to keep doing things and commit more of my life and make a decision that this is where I'm going to put the primary focus of my life and my livelihood into this kind of situation here, which is rather unconventional, without the community being conscious of it. You know, if the community as a group was unconscious of the developments in my kind of choices and involvements, I felt a little bit funny about that. So we had a meeting that anybody who was invited to could come to at Li Lane's house, and some 25 people came. So, and we discussed the different ideas people had about the future for the Sangha and visions and stuff. And some people missed the old days when we were really small and intimate. And some people wanted us to see us develop and arrange. And they asked me for my vision. And I told them I was reluctant to tell them my vision because I didn't see my... I was reluctant to kind of bring out my vision because I thought maybe my job was more to listen and then respond to the request rather than put out a big vision, which is easy to be visionary, to dream. So they asked me, so I told them, and which involved having a center, our own property for ourselves, a place where we can do as much activity as we want without having to ask for permission and requests and schedule problems with other people. And then it was realized that in order to do that, we had to incorporate as a nonprofit. And so a group of people started that process. And I was feeling still that I really wanted the community to come together and organize itself in a sense. So I stayed out of those meetings for a long time for incorporating, kind of coming up with bylaws and stuff. And then at some point I was invited in, I came and joined the meetings, and it was very difficult actually for a group of people to decide on bylaws and how to organize themselves. And we spent basically 2 years working out the process, and not always so successfully, our group process. I apologize and somewhat sad to say. Everybody did their very best, and the end result is now that we did the simplest way we could do it. We streamlined the whole process in the simplest possible way. We kind of came up with bylaws and sent in papers to the government for filing. And how I understand this nonprofit status that we now formed is that it's the equivalent of acquiring the Buddhist alms bowl. In Asia, the Buddhist monks go out on alms. Their sustenance for life came from what was given to them in their bowl. And in America, the equivalent of that in some ways of institution is this nonprofit status. And once we have that bowl in place, something can happen. We're available for something to happen. Without that status, we're not available for something to happen of any kind of serious degree. And you know the story of Ajahn Sumedho in England? Ajahn Sumedho is a Californian who went to UC Berkeley. Mid-60s, he went to England, went to Thailand and became a Theravadan Buddhist monk. And then in the late 70s, he moved to England, to London, to be a teacher there. And he was a forest monk, and forest monks every morning go out for the alms rounds with their begging bowl. And no one in London knew, had a clue what this guy was about, you know, in the orange robes and this big bowl and shaved head. But he would go out in his alms anyway. And occasionally someone would know, or they'd stop and ask him or something. One day, this guy was jogging by or biking by, and he stopped and said, "Who are you and what's your story? What's going on here?" And Ajahn Sumedho explained to him that he was a Buddhist monk, and it's a custom of Buddhist monks to go out every day to collect whatever food that people want to give them to, so they have food for that day. And that's what he was doing. And the fellow said, "Oh, so you're a forest monk. Can I put a forest in your bowl?" And he had been given, or he had this big forest someplace outside of London that he didn't particularly want anymore.
He had to eat it all, that's it.
What?
He had to eat it all.
Yeah. And so I suppose that Ajahn Sumedho went through the paperwork and got a nonprofit status in England, and probably the equivalent to what we have to do here. And then they were given this forest, which then, I think they sold it pretty quickly because for another property nearby that was more suited. But that was how He's a stranger. Can you, he just came up. Someone who didn't even know about Buddhism. Just, here you go. So we have now this status. Well, we will have it shortly. So who knows what will come into the begging bowl. I have a tremendous...
A big bowl.
What?
We have to get you a big bowl.
A big bowl. When I think of what we have to offer our community here, I think that it needs, it should happen. It's, I think, a tremendously wonderful and healthy and useful and important thing to happen. And to be able to have a Buddhist community meditation center for this community here, I think it was a great offering. And it should happen. So I believe in that. But when I think about the price in Palo Alto for such a thing, then I get discouraged. Because the price around here is phenomenally expensive. So I don't know how it's going to happen. My faith is that it'll happen within 20 years. But I don't want to wait 20 years. That's too long. Yes? I have thought of it a little bit, and I've thought of it and looked into it a little bit, and I'll do it more. But still, the problem is, as soon as you go into use other people's space, we're limited what we can do, because they're using it also. So part of my vision is to have a community meditation center that allows us to have a regular schedule of meditation sessions in the morning, maybe the afternoon. A place where we can do evening classes like this, maybe even like a Sunday morning thing, which they do at some places, which is very nice. More classes during the week of other various kinds that other people can teach besides me. Other kinds of events, weekend retreats, maybe longer retreats, maybe small retreats of 20 people, but for maybe 10 days. To have all those things coexist in some healthy way for this community, kind of, and create a sacred space. I think our society, I believe our society has a great need for sacred space. And because of the great pain, the suffering and fragmentation and violence that exists in many parts of our culture, you know, corporate culture, wherever. And I think Silicon Valley needs a contemplative place in the middle of this kind of valley as a balance, as a place to go, a refuge, if nothing else, as a reminder of another way of living, another way of other kinds of values that's so easy to forget when we're busy in our active lives. And so that's there's a title of a book edited by Thich Nhat Hanh about Buddhist precepts. It's an anthology of different writers. And the title is called For a Future to be Possible. And I think it's a beautiful title. And we often, when we teach mindfulness meditation in Buddhism, we tend to focus a lot on, you know, here and now, right? Paying attention, being in the present moment. But I think part of being in the present moment, the deep present moment, is to actually have a relationship to the past and the future. It doesn't involve getting lost in it, but to really understanding it well. And part of understanding the future is to see our connection to the future. And understand that in order for the practice, spiritual practice, for Buddhist practice, for Buddhism, to continue, we have to pass it on to the next generations. We can't just simply practice for ourselves, you know, in our own little practice and just be quiet. We have to. It requires the Sangha itself to take responsibility for the continuity and the development. And so part of this vision then is for a future to be possible, for a future for us, for our community in many generations to come. So I don't know how this is going to happen, but this is the kind of one of the beginnings, or, you know, a very important milestone for us. The function of such in the vision, we have a vision statement, which was very beautifully done up, and when we finish, maybe you can put it up, half of them out at the door. And half of them can stay here, and anybody who wants a copy of the vision statement can read it. But it's written here that this community's meditation center that we would like to have, well, is supposed to have three intertwining functions. to provide a simple and quiet environment where the contemplative life can be developed and protected amidst the complexities of city living, to offer those teachings, practices, and practice opportunities which complement insight meditation in supporting a balanced spiritual life from a Buddhist perspective, to be a place where people can come together to cultivate and express their practice in and through their family, social, and community life. And then it says more here. So I don't know what the next step should be. And that's the big question for me, is what to do next in terms of this. So how is it for you all to hear all this? So what do you have to say besides that?
Isn't the next step to put out the bowl? To solicit contributions to fund a nonprofit?
I suppose that's one of the next steps, is to somehow do fundraising. One of the things I'm concerned about is the exhaustion that can come around fundraising. And I've kind of vowed, maybe more to myself than anyone, that whatever way all this happens, it has to happen hopefully in a way that none of us gets exhausted, that we keep our inspiration, and that it comes from a sense of surplus, a sense of abundance from us, rather than a sense of tiring us out. I've seen many groups get really tired because of the strain for fundraising. So maybe it means it's slow, the process. Or maybe it means it's fast. I mean, what happened if we suddenly found a place, the perfect place, and it was put in the market, and we had to just raise something in 3 months? Could we do it suddenly? I don't know. Being galvanizing around something sometimes raises more money than kind of amorphous fundraising for something in the future. But I don't know how it's going to be. I guess probably it's going to be amorphous, or maybe a combination of it, or I don't know what's going to come in the bowl, you see. It could be, you know, it could be a forest. Some of you might have a forest somewhere. Some of you might, you know, or some of you have, who knows?
For me, it's a little scary.
Sorry?
For me, this is a little scary because I come here basically to get away from these things.
Yeah.
You know, to quiet down, to sit. And suddenly there's this movement,
yes,
there, you know, and I would have joined a political group.
Well,
yes,
I think your sentiments are very important for me, and I have a lot of trepidation or apprehension about this project also. And one of them is that I was actually reluctant to talk to all of the group. You spend Monday evening talking about this, because I feel like Monday evening is kind of special and sacred, and we should just keep it, you know, really in the kind of the simple thing we do of sitting in a Dharma talk. And I didn't know if a lot of you would even want to hear about this kind of stuff. But I felt the responsibility, and also, well, I felt it was important at least to present at this point what we're doing. And what I hope very much is that people will come like you and find a place to support you in what you want here, and not feel at all like you're being pulled into something you don't want to be part of. And you find it's a refuge, a place you can sit, and that there's not a lot of this, you know, busy fundraising activity or pressure or all these things you might expect. I want the poorest and simple informal feeling to continue throughout whatever we develop, where anybody feels they can come, they can get nurtured, and they can go home without any pressure or demands on them. So that what happens as we develop arises from within each of us as our inspiration rather than the group pressure or whatever.
Yeah.
And something like that will do. And one of the ideas I had was at some point in a few months, maybe in January, we could have a meeting some other night of the week, maybe a Sunday evening or something, and invite it to anybody who wants to come and to talk about what the next steps might be. and for the people who want to be part of this in whatever way, both in terms of the conversation and in terms of doing something. There's been a lot of people involved already. There's a current people who are involved in the last stage of the process, kind of the final signing of the documents and coming to the last meetings. There's about maybe how many? 7, 8 people?
Oh,
is that right? And not all of them are here. But I think it'd be okay. I didn't ask any of them if I could do this, but maybe a few of them, you can just stand for a moment. And then if any of you want to talk to the people who are kind of on the board, who are kind of involved with organizing so far, you could talk to them and tell them your fears and your inspirations, because rather than, you know, I don't know if all, I'm not, you know, it's difficult if all the focus is on me. So would you mind doing that, maybe, Elizabeth, and Bernice, and Marty? Is Marty here? A lot of the people are here today, and Cheryl. Cheryl and Bernice and Elizabeth and who else? They're all not here today. All this hard work and Richard and Bill and Steve. Anything else? Yes.
I share the appreciation for this place, a place to develop my practice and increasing importance of the people here in the Sangha. I share the excitement about the idea. One concern that I have, similar to that, is just that hearing the word religion pop up repeatedly tonight, where it really pretty much when you talk is not.
That's used.
And that word together with an organizational structure, bylaws and officers and all that, that's those particular combination of things make me uncomfortable. So just thought I'd bring that up and appreciate your and that awareness of the importance, you'd say, the porousness of this.
Yeah. Yes. Great. Yes, Jean.
I just wanted to say that the thing that I think was important for me to hear that was maybe I heard it before, but it's stuck in this time, is that when you said that you wanted the group to be conscious of the choices you were making as you were increasing your level of commitment by choosing to spend more time on
yeah.
I'm concerned about the price that the group will pay and with all the complexity that will come with all this long list of things.
Yeah, I'm very concerned about these issues too, and I'm committed to trying to find a way to do it that can keep in the spirit that we've had already, continue that, and that'll be part of the trick. But you know, my sense is that my understanding is that all groups have group process and phases they go through, and it's inevitable. You can't expect a group to stay static, and even if we want it to be that way. And so and groups evolve through stages, which sometimes are, you know, just a, you know, last week I talked about the honeymoon stage, you know. There's a honeymoon stage and there's difficulty stage and there's a stability stage, and you know, there's all kinds of stages they go through, like any kind of relationship. I myself don't know how to avoid change in this context. Something has to happen. I mean, there's many things that could happen. There's many directions that something can take, but something has to happen. One of my motivations for this is that I feel very responsible to all of you, and I would like to see something here that not only lasts into the future, but it offers something in a responsible way for all the commitment and interest and that you all have. If you just continue the way we're, you know, on Cowper Street, if you just continue in a small way, I don't know if it's sustainable. I don't know if it's sustainable for me. you know, that way. I don't know if it's sustainable with all the pressure I feel, all the people who want something a little bit different and want something more and everything. So you know, I feel actually sometimes a lot of pressure from many different directions, including within me, for change. Change has to happen. One of the changes that happens with groups, the fifth stage, according to some people, are five stages of group development, is either growth or disbandment. And that's a possibility. You know, that's actually one of the possibilities. You know, if we stay exactly the same, I don't know if I would stay for years and years. But however long I stay, I mean, the bigger we become, I feel the more commitment I make to staying. But also, at some point, I will leave, or I'll die, or something will happen, right, to me? And I feel that I want to get it large enough so that two things can happen. One is large enough so we can invite in another teacher to teach with me. Because I think it's very healthy for us to have at least two teachers. And so there isn't just all this focus on one person. And so that one person, so also there's a team teaching, and they support each other. So we become large enough so we can support two teachers. And then large enough so that if something happens to me, that it becomes a place that some other teacher either can grow up out of the Sangha or another teacher we can invite in. But if we just, you know, stayed 12 people, or stayed 40 people, or stayed 60 people, or stayed where we are right now, I think it's very hard for me, you know, to cast out or across America for all the different Dharma teachers floating around and happen to find one that's willing to move to Palo Alto. But if we have a more of established, for you, and I hope that as we go through this, that if at any point anybody's uncomfortable with anything, that part of what a Sangha means, it's a place where you should feel safe to say you're uncomfortable. If you don't feel like you can say that you're uncomfortable, either to me directly or to someone else who's kind of in the Sangha or to the whole group, then you probably shouldn't stay in the Sangha. Actually, you should go away. Or figure out some way you can say it. Or find something. Don't stay in this group with feelings of discomfort without saying it. And if we can state that, then hopefully whatever way we develop can be respectful for everyone, and we can do it in a healthy way. And so I'll end with, if I may, a quote by Scott Peck, who wrote a book on community. A healthy organization, whether a marriage, a family, or a business corporation, is not one with an absence of problems, but one that is actively and effectively addressing or healing its problems. And I think that's probably a more realistic attitude. And after all, the first noble truth, right? So, those of you who want to just check out what the vision statement is, you can either pick it up at the back door, or there's some up here. And I hope that this is inspiring for enough of you, and I hope enough of you share also my fright.